views and opinions expressed on this podcast are solely those of the individuals involved and do not reflect the views or endorsement of any entity. Nothing being said on this podcast should be considered as investment advice.
Love that intro music. Welcome back, GMGM. Happy Friday.
Happy Friday. We made it to the end of the week. We're good to go.
We did. We're alive and well. We're healthy.
We are healthy. We're feeling good. We actually have a pretty fun episode today.
This is going to be a great show.
Yeah, we just went through it. We've got some fun stuff to talk about.
There's so much good content in today's show. Welcome, everyone, to 100 Proof. This is our weekly live show where we talk about all things NFTs, digital art, collectibles,
socks, high socks, shoes.
I'm the one that's flooding today with Tom Sacks.
I have those shoes. They're great shoes.
They're the best. They're really good. You can get them. You can't buy them new today, but you can get them on those secondary markets.
I'm also rocking the OG Metaverse Fashion right here. Admit 1, ITO 1.
I still have mine. Mine is in my, I haven't opened it up yet. I actually need to pull it out of the box.
I got one to keep in the box and I got one to wear.
Nice. Love it. All right. So obviously Derek, Collab Currency, Sam, Proof's Director of Research, is here as well. What's up, Sam?
On mute. What's up, everyone? How you doing?
You
got the jacket on. It's cold in Colorado.
What's going on with the jacket? Looking like, I love the double layer.
It's just the camera. You know, Mao hooks it up.
He's actually looking very like fashionable.
Right, I know. Now. I like it. Is it the haircut? Is it
something's different?
The clean shave? Is it I think it could be the layers. He's got like 3 shirts on.
Yeah.
The layers texture. Look good.
You know, yesterday I was on a video with Sam. He was wearing all pink. Like he had a pink undershirt, a pink jacket on top. Like he was pinked out.
Pink is his thing.
It is his thing. And of course, we got Amanda, Proof's culture and community head. Amanda, good to have you here, aka Stevie.
What's up? What's up? I was actually looking last night before I went to bed for some Tom Sacks and could not find them. It's kind of
Stock
a bummer.
StockX.
Yeah, I don't know.
You're going to be paying up on StockX.
You do pay up. You do pay up.
I'm not a secondary person, ironically, right?
There's a spot around the corner here.
Yeah.
We're in downtown LA. In the arts district right now, and there's a couple spots actually nearby that might be able to swag you up.
Nice. Yeah.
I got the FOMO with you guys and your cool shoes, so I gotta go. It's gotta good step stuff. It up.
Eli is not here today. Eli is hard at work on new drops. You know, we got grills coming up. We got a bunch of stuff coming up. So Eli is very busy.
We don't miss him though. It's fine.
We do miss Eli. Later on the show, we have a couple special guests: Felikin McCormick and Sophia. From Entangled Others, fantastic group of artists, collaborators that have created some really beautiful pieces, all tied around natural art and DNA. And just like, there's so much to dive into here. We're going to have them on the show and talk to them about their creative process. We have a London event next week. So we have artwork by Peter Seville and Stephen Morris at the Proof Pace collaboration at the Freeze event in London on October 11th. So if you want to come out to that, it's going to be absolutely fantastic. events.proof.xyz. I'm sad. I'm not going to be out there in Freeze.
It's all right.
There's just too much going on right now, but Proof is representing a bunch of us. Eli will be out there. Maggie's going to be out there. There's going to be a whole crew out in London chatting with you all and showing you some really, really cool art in connection with one of the top galleries in the world, which obviously is Pace. So very excited to see us still charging hard and forward on the art front. Before we get started, we've missed Sam a little bit this week. We haven't got as much our full fill of Sam. So Sam, you have some market stats and a little market overview you'd prepared for us today. Let's go.
Let's go. Yeah, no. So they didn't do the daily this week. So I consolidated the whole week into 5 quick slides, just like what's been going on in the market. I'll give you the quick overview. You know, this first chart here just looks at overall volumes. And whenever I put a volume chart, I always have to figure out, do I want to do like 3 months, 2 years? Like what kind of scale do I want to do? And here, I think there are two interesting things in this chart. This goes all the way back to July of 2021. And the volumes this week on kind of and ETH NFTs were the lowest that they've been over a 1 week period going all the way back to July of 2021. So really, really low volume. The other thing you can't see in this chart that I think is kind of relevant is that Blur has gone from, it was kind of consistently 70 to 80% market share. And this past week it's gone to 50 to 60% market share. So you've seen Blur kind of fall out a little bit. I think a couple things have happened. One, the Matt Cain project was almost all traded on OpenSea. Two, one of the Yuga, like part of their vessel or one of their new NFTs is only being traded on X2Y2. So they got a little bit of, you're seeing a little bit of movement to other exchanges, a little bit less farming. When it comes to prices though, one of the interesting things is that, you know, it used to be that volume up was celebrated. Someone did a lot of volume and all of Twitter would retweet that. That was a great thing. This past year though, because the majority of volume in 2023 has been people selling into bids, low volume actually isn't always that bad for prices. And with the low volumes, we actually saw a little bit of an uptake in the PFP index. Pudgy Penguin's doing well. A couple other projects doing well. And then this other chart here is ArtBlocks. I think there was a huge pump in ArtBlocks that happened with the first Sotheby's auction. So the second one was the Goose, but the first one, and I'm talking about the first one of the Starry Night portfolio or the Three Arrow Capital portfolio. Sorry. When that first auction happened, Fidenza sold for $1 million and the entire ArtBlocks complex rose. And we've kind of seen a gradual sell off since then. And you can see that in that second chart. In terms of the biggest sales of the week, a Fidenza sold yesterday for 120 ETH.
That's a damn
pretty awesome
one.
Sale.
Look at that.
Yes. Yeah, such a beauty. And it was an over-the-counter trade. Suzanne NFT, one of my favorite Twitter commentators on ArtBlocks, has a really good thread about this piece and what makes it awesome. So check that out. I retweeted it. In the upper right there, this was bought by Curated, but that's a five-color spread Chromie Squiggle, which sold for 17 ETH. And then looking at the one-on-one sales, kind of one of the interesting things right now is that one-on-one sales have slowed down a lot too. So this past week, there wasn't a single one-of-one sale for more than 10 ETH, but this piece, lower left, a Grails artist, Yatreda, I mean, just such an awesome artist. This is the top one-on-one sale of the week, and it's actually a minute and a half. It's an animation where the baby, there's just movement in everyone's eyes, and
you trade it, she's so good. Sam, are you a fan?
I'm a huge fan. I mean, her and Joey, but she's and she had such a great Grail this year too, so
yeah. I've her other work too. Have you ever seen the one with the snakes coming off the back and shit, like the crazy snakes? Have you seen that?
It's
one?
Not jumping in mind.
Oh man, I'm sure so good. It's like these like skeleton snakes coming off. They're a fantastic team. Anyway, I just wanted to throw that in there. What was the last one?
For sure.
That was
the last one here is a piece called Stranger Tech by C3, and this one sold for 8 ETH, and that was the second biggest sale of the week. And then two more slides. This one is the Ephemeral Visions by AOTM. Are the Millennium? They had this overall sale with 18 pieces. Overall, they sold for 37 ETH, and they got all sorts of different artists, you know, from all sorts of different levels of visibility. And the goal here was to focus on the transient essence of existence. I put three of my favorite pieces below there. You know, one sold for 7.77 ETH. That's the one in the middle by Luis Ponce. The one in the right is by the one and only Brian Brinkman. The one in the left by Laura L. But overall, I think a pretty successful sale for this market from AOTM. And then the last thing, and I know we're going to talk about this, but just, you know, we were talking about this before the show, the Matt Cain drop was Super Rare Genesis Pass. And for those who don't know, Super Rare Genesis Pass has done 11 drops until now. Anyone who owns one, they're 250, is entitled to a new drop every single month. And they've had artists from Pinder Van Armen to OSF, to many others. But Matt Cain dropped his this week, and we're going to talk about that. But I think one of the most interesting things about it is it actually is, for all the controversy of all the drops that have happened on the Genesis Pass, this is the one that has the highest floor price, more than double the second highest floor price. So something is happening here where the price is working. If you look at all of Matt Cain's work that he's done till now, this collection has the second highest valuation of everything. So higher valuation than the Anons that he dropped last week, only behind Gazers. So super interesting stuff. I'll end there and we can talk more, but that's kind of my 1 week wrap up in 4 minutes.
Yeah, I mean, controversy gets people talking, and if it's a good collection, like you can see what happened here with Matt Cain. I'm just telling people, Moonbirds has had a lot of controversy. Where's our floor? Let's go. Let's go. It's coming any day now. One thing, quick question for you, Sam, and for you, Derek, is like, you know, we heard a few weeks ago now that Chromie Squiggles had that, you know, that more or less a little bit of a bug where they weren't representing the data in the right way. Got some people to reevaluate how they think about certain attributes there. You know, there was... This kind of reminds me of, it's not the same, but like the original CryptoPunks, and then how V1 was then later shuttered and V2 was the main collection. Are we seeing any collectors going in and buying Chromie Squiggles? I saw one there. Are any of them buying them based on the new data? Have you guys seen that?
I have definitely seen some activity around some of the new, let's call it discovered mathematical traits. There's been, I think I saw Cosmo actually buy a piece. One of the identified new mathematical traits. I think I've seen one or two others that have sold. But the majority of the squiggles that have traded over the last couple of weeks haven't really been.
Okay, so that one we just saw with Sam is not based on that. Then that was just a good pickup.
Well, I can tell you why I curated about that, because I actually have a pretty good sense of how they're thinking about it. This is a low color spread. I think it's a color spread 5. It's a beautiful squiggle.
So no doubt.
These low color spread squiggles are actually typically, there's like a trade. They usually tend to trade just above the floor, maybe a little bit above the floor. I think they got this one for 17 ETH, but they really pack a punch visually. They're not, they have the appearance of what a perfect spectrum or a full spectrum would look like. You're seeing the full color variety of the squiggle here, but they're not. And so their view is, they've always had this collector view around floor plus, which is like there's these brilliant squiggles that exist just above the floor with very low color spreads, and that's typically where they like to play. So that's, I mean, I just have some understanding and the motivation there. The last thing I'll say is, you know, the mathematical traits that were discovered actually don't affect most of the collection. It really just has to do with this one trait called, and it was a community source trait, the perfect spectrum and full spectrum. The majority of collectors don't actually collect on those traits to begin with.
Yeah.
That's not how I collect. That's not how you collect.
No.
And frankly, most of the folks that collect don't collect based on community traits like that.
Right.
So I would say the market hasn't really shifted in terms of the motivation for why people are buying squiggles or how they think about the collection. It affects, you know, less than 0.5% of the entire collection.
Okay. That's super helpful. Awesome. Well, let's move on to Amanda. Amanda, any how's the chat doing these days?
Chat's
going
good.
Any audience questions at all?
I see from Josh H. I think that's Pyro, right? He says that he thinks Curated bought a double full spectrum for 17 ETH potentially. So maybe that happened recently.
I think that was that one.
Was that one?
But okay. That wasn't. I can tell you right now, that wasn't the motivation behind buying that squiggle.
It
probably just so happened to be. I don't even know if that's even a trade.
Double full spectrum.
So it sounds like there's some crossover between some of like the community identified traits.
Yeah.
The traits are so nuts how these people are. It sounds like we're ordering like an advanced Starbucks order, like the double latte, where it's like,
yes.
It's just made up shit.
Well, you know? So this is the beauty of this project. It's like you can actually go quite deep with like the community trait stuff, which I love. Like I love that this vector for collectability exists.
It's geekiness.
It's geekiness,
people that nerd
out, awesome.
Which I love that. Yeah.
But then there's also, you know, like the original reason like that this thing is visually interesting is the low color spread. That was the artist's intent.
Yeah.
And that is typically how Curated collects.
All right. Any other questions real quick?
I just want to shout out some of the people who are in the chat. You see Oliver, he just bought a Proof Collective pass. I love that he's jumping in, coming to hang out. I love that. I see Eli, but who cares? I see Derek, one of our awesome artists. He's amazing. I see Lynette, an amazing community member. Just want to shout them all out. And Yuko, too, from Community Council. So hi, everyone. Sorry if I missed you. And Justin's in the chat, so I love that.
I got to tell you, this is not, we say at the beginning of the show, we'll say it again, this is not investment advice. I see the Proof Collective passes, and I'm like, how many grails do we have left? Like, I'm like, I might pick up a couple of these passes because they're getting really attractive now.
Yeah.
Getting close. Don't go buy based on what I just said. Just like, just for me personally, when I think about collecting this stuff, we got some good drops coming. All right. Let's move into the Matt Cain and Super Rare conversation. This was, you know, obviously Matt Cain is one of the Rare Pass artists, dropped this like really insane collection of, big departure from what we typically see from Matt Cain in terms of his visual style. This is called Contractual Obligations. A little bit of a knife twisty stab into Super Rare and the fact that he did sign a contract and had to deliver this type of art. And then he hops on a space with Super Rare and did quite the performance art on this on the stage. It was a really fun one to listen to, just because I love odd, fun, funky characters. And for me, Matt is a creative. And when I listen to this whole rant slash, you know, chaos that was that space, it is an artist being an artist, right? Definitely. And so I really enjoyed it, actually.
Yeah, I have some thoughts here.
Yeah, let's go.
The first thing I'll say is this is very much like institutional critique. Like you flagged this, Kevin. This is not Matt Cain's typical style. I think there is this common like view that when an artist uses or leverages AI, that like they're offsetting, you know, the creation around and the skillfulness of the process to the machine. And so that has to be done in a very delicate way. And it felt like from artists like Pindar Van Armen and others that the use of AI here was really, I don't want to say low effort, but just like not conducive to like how Matt Cain creates work, or the sophistication of how Matt Cain is known to create work. And so in light of that, you know, the piece itself is very much a critique on the pass, the Super Rare pass itself, where, you know, they sourced a number of artists to do 250 unique edition drops over the course of, you know, 12 months. Him feeling compelled to do this thing, the manner by which he brought the work was really meant as a commentary against it. The thing I'll say is the work itself is actually like quite striking. It's all in service to this larger idea, this commentary, this critique of Super Rare pass, of middlemen, of what it means to like push back against the, you know, the value extraction or the value provision that might be happening at the platform level, which I find to be just like, you know, this is good. I mean, like, we need to have these conversations, and I think he's doing an amazing job surfacing these conversations.
Yeah.
I will also say on the other side, like, I'm team Super Rare. Like, I love Matt Cain. I love his work. I actually really love this collection.
You're also an investor in Super Rare.
I am an early angel investor in Super Rare. I've seen how hard those guys work to really bring into it. I mean, frankly, there was no one in service to artists back when Super Rare created. They pioneered what it meant to create a platform and build the profile of artists and, frankly, kickstart an entire industry. They innovate, they take chances. I know the team over there very well, Zach, John, these guys really do what they do in service to art. And they, you know, gave Matt space, literally a Twitter spaces, to be able to provide this commentary and, you know, show this work. And so I think two things can be true. I think this collection is awesome. I think Matt Cain is surfacing an important discussion. And I will also say that Super Rare is doing, you know, a great job trying to promote and surface and curate great art to the public.
Sam, what's your take on this?
Man, I got so many. One question I have for Derek, though, because you probably understand this better than I do, is what actually changed? I mean, obviously, no one forced Matt to join as far as artists who participated. What changed for Matt from January, December of last year when it was announced to now that he wanted to kind of make the statement?
Yeah, I think this is the thing about taking chances, is like in a vacuum, when you're making these decisions 12 months ago, 18 months ago, about what the world will look like, you have a very defined view on how things are going to shake out. And at the time, putting together a pass that allowed people to get exposure to really great art through a single vehicle month after month with the constraint of 250 unique editions sounded a lot different than it probably does today, where we look at one of your charts, Sam, and like demand has dropped and volume has dropped. And, you know, for, you know, in large part, we're seeing this consolidation happening in the industry, which is healthy. And a contraction was always kind of like a necessary evil to like get to the next leg and the next stage. But to have to be, you know, release work in suboptimal conditions because of a contract not based on an artist's intent to deliver the best possible work, it's kind of a hard constraint to be forced into 18 months after you've agreed to it, or 12 months after you've agreed to it. So I totally take his point. Like, this is a conversation that I think is worth having, but I wouldn't necessarily blame anyone in particular. I think this is a function of how the space has evolved in a way that maybe our information sets didn't provide. It's a function of Matt having agreed to this project a long time ago and Super Rare having created a very compelling use of the Rare Pass to deliver this work. So, you know, it's hard to point fingers, but I think at a minimum, this is a conversation that is important to have. I think the work is exceptional. And I think this is something that I'm excited to see out there.
One of the things that's interesting to me is that the artists have really taken off, and I would put Matt in this class in terms of massive following independently on Twitter. Pendar's in this class. There's a number of artists that have a big enough following that when they point their fire hose to something, call it a new mint, like they're going to get attention to wherever they point, right? And so this is something I think about a lot because as it applies to proof, it's like when we do a drop with an artist, what value can we really bring to them? Because, Matt, for example, just did a drop on a Manifold contract that I'm pretty sure it was a Manifold contract that he did his own and made 200 ETH. Mm-hmm. And there was that's essentially cutting out the middle person here, right? And saying, I don't need a big platform to do this. I can just do this independently on my own contract that I own. And, why should I be giving Super Rare any cut of this? And so that's a valid point. And I think it's something that we're all going to have to face. Like when Proof comes in and says like, hey, we want to take X percent of the drop, call it 5, 10, 15% of your drop. We have to make sure we're really, truly pushing a ton of value here, meaning like there has to be promotion videos, there has to be email newsletters that go out, there has to be, and if you're not doing that, then the artist should just go and do it on their own.
I think you're bringing up a great point, which is, and I think this work does a good job of that, it calls into question, like, we need to make sure that if we are working with partners, if we are working with platforms, that the value provision that is being given out by these platforms is narrowly scoped to the percentage rake that they're taking on the outcome. And I think that's fair. I think that's what this technology does, right? It's transparent. It's democratic. It calls into questions like how, programmatic revenue should flow to different partners, and everybody can view it and comment on it. This is what I love about this collection. It surfaces those questions in real time.
It got me thinking.
Exactly.
It really did, because I got to tell you, when I was talking to Eli yesterday, we were talking about our upcoming drops over, call it the next 6 months. And we were talking about the percentages that we were going to, what was our rake going to be, our take going to be on these drops. And you almost have to think about it as like an a la carte menu, where you go to an artist and you say, artist, you are oftentimes an individual. Maybe if they're really professional, they have an assistant or something like that. If they're starting to be an up and coming artist that has some traction. And you say, how can we extend and amplify what you do? And so if we're just going to talk about it on the podcast, we don't need to take anything. We can just do that and talk about it, because we naturally do that anyway. If we're going to go and send a whole production team and crew and editors to go and cut a piece about your background, your story, your history, and promoting all those things, then we talk about different percentages. And there's like, has to be this spectrum.
Yeah, yeah.
Right.
And I'm so with you.
I feel like every platform is going to have to figure that out. Like, what is it that we provide? And then have a dynamic, percentage of the drop based on the actual value that's being added.
And I guess the last thing I'll say is it's easy. Here's what I'll say. I think it's easy to find yourself on one side of this argument. And I would just urge people to sit in the nuance and understand both sides, because I think that's what the point of this piece was to do.
Yeah.
It was to really imbue the industry with these questions, not provide answers. And I think that is the mark of a really great institutional critique and a really great collection. So I'm excited to see this one starting to kind of be discussed publicly.
Yep. Awesome. Yeah. Lastly, the one sentence I'll add is that everyone here, including everyone at Proof, we want to see Super Rare survive and thrive. I mean, they're such
Those
an important institution to what we do. And they were beating the drum when we weren't even around, before anyone else. Right. So you gotta love that and respect that.
I'll throw in one thing. I mean, I know we're going a little over here, but I think, this was particularly interesting to me. Like, one contrast is what happened with Sam Spratt. I mean, Sam Spratt was the artist of the summer. Monument Game was what this entire community just rallied around. And I think when he finished that, like he probably wanted to be done creating art. 1 week later, he had a super rare drop. He had to drop three pieces, and it kind of has some interesting parallel. Obviously, he did three, whereas Matt had to come out and do 250, and he ended up putting three characters from Monument Game in. But I thought that was super interesting, and I remember thinking the same thing when that happened. Like, that is very weird timing for Sam, who kind of just wants to be done right now, but it kind of went a different way. The other thing, one of the messages that Matt had is similar to something that VVD had with No Pep and Drop a little while ago, which was, you know, people are betting on my art before they even know what it is. And there's this idea of these unrevealed pieces. Oh, Pepin launched, or VVD launched No Pepin, and it just ended up being like basically just a color with another color kind of on it. And yeah. VVD ultimately said, like, if you're betting on me before you even know what it is, that's kind of on you. And Matt said something similar. It's like, you know, he said, there, I have a lot of art out there now. You can pick which one you like and which one you don't. And there's kind of a bit of a statement about this like pre-reveal betting that kind of happens in the space. And I thought that was, there were so many different sub-narratives to this. Those are just a couple of them.
Yeah. Great point, Sam.
I know we're way over at this point. I'll have one last thing here, because I think
I'll have the last one after that.
I will have one more after that. No, the only thing I'll say is like, these are important questions to be talking about. I know Super Rare is thinking very deeply about them. I know when I go to source new artists, it's not going to be on some landing page that they created and are shouting out into the void. Super Rare, Artblocks, number of these platforms, Prohibition, they play such an important role in helping the discovery process of finding new work and new artists, that to throw out the baby with the bathwater is not the answer. It's to constantly investigate how can improvements be made. And that's, I think, the big takeaway from
that's
me
what
here.
Web3 needs to be. Yeah. We listen, we adapt.
Anyone, I mean, like you said, Kevin, I mean, Matt had a 200 ETH sale 2 weeks ago. Very few artists like don't need the carrier at this point. He's just one of those guys.
Yeah.
Yep. Awesome. All right. Well, let's move on. We love Matt. Matt's a legend, obviously. And it's cool to see this one just take off with all the controversy. Audience questions. Amanda.
We have some comments, some really good conversation happening here. I want to shout out Stephen Bernacki, who gave a quote that says, art needs to be allowed to make us feel things sometimes. Sometimes that's uncomfortable, right? Mm-hmm. Like, art makes you feel something. And I think that was part of this entire narrative this week, is just so many different thoughts and takes and everything. You know, even Justin is saying that, you know, part of this sort of issue was that Matt Cain mentioned that Super Rare was almost pushing the past to the side and not giving them the platform that the artists still deserve. And so I think that that's another sort of important take, is that, you know, if we use these platforms to, you know, these artists' advantage, there has to be some sort of advantage there. And hopefully it feels bi-directionally advantageous, is what Justin says. And then Nyx is here, and he says, he makes a really great point that, sure, Matt could do it himself, but emerging artists or ones new to Web3 need those platforms. And 100%. I think that's true, right? Like, and so I think that that's a major point to note here, and the value of these platforms, for sure.
Yep, awesome. Are you a fan of this one, Amanda, out of curiosity? Did you like the art?
I do. I mean, I love a narrative. I love a good narrative. Like, mm-hmm. that is what makes most of this art sort of valuable, I think, especially in Web3. And I think if I was a rare pass holder and I got one, like, I would be really happy just to have this, like, little moment of history, right? I don't know if I would buy one right now at 6 ETH, but, like, you know, GG, good for everyone, I think. Yeah. But I love the art. Love the art.
Awesome. And then you have a story coming up here about these awesome MoMA postcards. Tell us more about this.
Yes. Okay. So everyone, I thought it was really funny, basically how quickly everyone clamored to take part in this, right? MoMA announced, the Museum of Modern Art announced a new sort of platform. It's called Postcards. To kind of kick this off, they worked with 15 artists to kind of test effectively this platform, right? So all throughout Twitter, you could see these 15 artists, including Grant Yoon, Ixchels, Operator, you know, a lot of really, really
Dimitri
big names.
Dimitri was in there.
Dimitri, yeah, Pixel Fool, Sasha, all these people, Kim Asendorf, right? And they all worked together to create an NFT that was like, you know, minted on the blockchain from Momo, right? That was a huge deal. Everyone is saying MoMA's getting into NFTs. I also wanted to highlight, like, if you go on their website, when they're advertising this, they're calling them NFTs and they're leaning into the words NFT, blockchain, that stuff. It's not digital art. And I think that that is actually a really big part of this entire like program and project, is that it is literally using the blockchain as this method, as this canvas to create something. And so I actually want to actually highlight, because a lot of people were like, when can I buy, you know, a Grant Yoon postcard? When can I buy this person's postcard? And that's actually not the point, but they did a really great job with the marketing. Because I think the big point is that it's a platform which allows you to create pixel art using their color palette, the MoMA color palette. And so each one of these artists was able to take part in this platform by creating their own sort of version of their little stamp. But when they allow it to be open for other people to claim, it's going to be a blank canvas, right? And then you are going to be sending it to other people. I don't think that it's going to be possible for you to get any of those pieces from these artists, actually. So I think, but basically they're trying to sort of highlight that artists can create this really awesome art. But if you want to participate, and you participate by getting access to the blank blank postcard and then sending it to 14 other people, you have to create those art, that art. Those people that you send it to have to create that art. So I think there's going to be some people who will have, you know, a really valuable one if they maybe know an artist who can create something. This is really, really mostly about co-creation on the blockchain. And then in that tweet from Autonomy, which is the wallet on Tezos that is being minted on, they mentioned this concept of co-ownership and co-creation. So technically, once it's done, you and 14 other people will share and co-own this NFT. And I think that's really interesting too. So it's clearly really, really a blockchain kind of game platform, really highlighting the benefits of NFTs. And I think that's incredibly powerful.
Yeah, I was gonna say, I would think we just all have to take a moment and pause and just say, realize for 1 second that this is MoMA doing this.
Yeah. Yeah.
This is yeah. Not a new startup coming up with a clever drop mechanic. This is MoMA doing this. Like, this is a big deal for our industry.
It's huge.
It's validation for the entire space, and it's something we should celebrate. It's a huge deal.
I think
deal.
We get so locked in on the day-to-day that we forget how big some of these wins actually are and how much they can move the needle. An institution like MoMA putting a stamp on this and, you know, speaking volumes about how blockchains work, how you can send and receive digital objects, like you can send and receive physical objects, like a postcard, and being able to create a campaign that's like analogous to how behaviors that people already do, while also teaching the value prop of how a trust minimized ledger can work, is really fucking cool.
Yeah.
And so, you know, like, I'm not saying that there's salable goods here that are going to rip 5,000% and then everyone's going to be wealthy because MoMA put, you know, their stamp on this thing. It's something bigger than that, which is another chain that's been reached that demonstrates why this movement is inevitable.
And if you're playing our bingo at home game,
what did I get?
He said, trust minimize ledger, everyone. Right, so go. Please stamp that take a shot. There we go.
I want Petri dish. Let's go
Sam
Petri
is
dish.
Me about this.
Petri dish.
Sam is on my case constantly about
store
this.
Of value. That's store. The big one. That's the big star.
If you get store value out of Derek, like that's a huge one. You get a free open edition from Derek.
I think what's particularly interesting to me, though, is that they came into the space and they created something that was innovative and unique and new, and it doesn't actually, it's not really sellable. Like, it's such a... Yeah. It's such a different creation that, like, everyone's, we're all so confused. Grant Yoon had to come out and tweet, like, people, you cannot buy this, you know? And I think it's, I'm curious what their angle was there. Like, I'm curious what MoMA's trying to say here. How is this chosen as their entry? What's the statement they're trying to make?
It's a good question. I work backwards from, like, who do I think that they're trying to reach? And the truth is like, this is an educational product. It's an educational product to talk about what digital art is, how blockchains work, how you can append information to objects to make them change over time based on this database of record. it's just an it's an educational venture, and the audience is people that aren't deep in the space. That's why there's so much confusion. It's actually not for us. Right. It's for a different audience, which I think is great, and gets back to Kevin's point, which is this is MoMA coming in, taking a stand and saying, here are what we deem to be valuable properties. Mm-hmm. Here's how they work. And here's how we think that they will be used for our audience in the future.
Yeah. Love it.
Yeah. I love it. I love it. I think the biggest thing that hopefully will be like an unlock is this concept of not commodifying NFTs and really like creating this like emotional connection to your NFTs and not and making you love it so much or love that memory so much that you're not even thinking about selling. It's not even about that. And I think that is a massive unlock. And maybe it's a little niche, but like I'm here for that.
And every person that goes to that webpage is like, I thought NFTs were a scam. Wait, MoMA's doing something? Yeah. And they're calling it NFTs?
Yeah.
Oh, wait, this must be something. Why would MoMA? Like, and it gets that process, which we really need happening. So, all right, let's move on to the next story. I know we're behind on this one. The Las Vegas Sphere. This thing is freaking badass.
I think it's so cool.
It's so
this
cool.
I know it's starting to get on the Twitter feed for folks, but like, not enough has been talked about around this thing and what it's a symbol for. So the quick and dirty 18K resolution wraparound LED screen. It costs $2.3 billion to make, measures 160,000 square feet with 166,000 speakers. It is the largest and highest res LED screen on planet Earth, and it's in Las Vegas. It's you can view it from the outside. You can view it from the inside. It's an event space. It's also this amazing billboard that I've heard you can pay like $250K for like 4 days of advertising.
Wow.
Right now. It's
cheap.
It will be equal.
It's cheap.
Let's go.
Let's go. What? That's nothing. Let's do it.
A few squiggles.
A handful
of moon birds.
It's,
you know?
It's already, they've had this killer musical performance. I think there's been a bunch of videos around it. U2 performed there. This is U2. I think CT's got it up on the screen
my God,
for us.
So
an
good.
Immersive concert that apparently was just like one of the most in-depth, interactive, immersive performances that people have ever been to. This is like what's coming out.
Can you believe this is in this dome? They're making it appear as though it turns into like a box.
It's totally wild. And I think given the resolution, I've heard, so here's a screen grab right here that CT has. It actually feels like the environment changes every time they flip.
I'm not trying to promote anything illegal, but you got to imagine people are taking mushrooms and going to this and just being like,
no drug-fueled parties, okay?
No, listen, like this is just a trippy-ass experience,
totally,
though, right?
Totally.
I feel really bad. I just wanted to say that, like, because all of the news about this was all about the LED screen and like how big it was and how expensive it was. I did not know that you could go inside. And I think that
Marks, you could go inside.
I did not know that it was an event venue. I thought it was just this really cool just ball. I don't know. So that's even better. That's like
totally.
So much better.
And I think the let's call it like the bottom line takeaway for this podcast is, I mean, like, it's just a perfect, like, example of where we're going with immersive screens, screen tech, screen display. This isn't lost on them. They already have the first artist in residence, which has been named to be Rafik Anadol. CT had the tweet that went out this week. You can imagine, digital interactive works of art that are ownable, that are sellable, appearing on screens like this all over the world in the future.
This is the thing, is when you see Rafik's work up on something like this.
Oh, yeah.
And I've seen Rafik's work in LAX. And I was at the airport and I saw it up on the screen. And his work is so just compelling and beautiful and flowing and moving. It causes people, I was watching from a distance, I was sitting there waiting for my plane, and people were stopping and pausing and taking pictures and watching. If we can get more of this, people see this and be like, damn, that's so beautiful. I want to own that on my wall.
100%.
I want to have that at home.
Yeah.
You know, and we'll get there. We'll get there. It's just going to take a minute.
The plan I've heard is to have these spheres all over the world. I think they've got like 11 or 12 that
we should make little tiny spheres that we'd like sell for our house.
Tiny
like,
spheres would be awesome too. I think...
Wouldn't that be cool? Just like a little tiny baby sphere you have, and then you can get all the artwork and it just wraps around
there's
it.
There's a business idea in there. I'll also just say more broadly, like I urge everybody to go out to a bar or go out to LACMA or go out to any of these institutions, and it's clear there is now this emphasis towards screens and screen display. I know when I went to the LACMA last month, and I may have even brought this up on the podcast, in the main courtyard, they've got multiple screens at this point showing Def Beef and Tyler Hobbs. And
why did you say go out to a bar? It's normally like football on the screens and shit.
Well, my point is, I've been going to a number of restaurants and bars lately that are actually now starting to put digital art on the screens.
Amazing.
Which is awesome. I mean, when the game's not on or it's mostly for like ornate display, interactive screens are now becoming part of the decor of like, I mean, I'm out in Los Angeles, so the data points may be different for others.
Derek's going to some fancy restaurants.
Yes. Okay.
Screen tech is now being imbued in like the actual experience of these restaurants. And I'm seeing it everywhere. And like, I think this is part of a much larger trend, which is we have a blockchain, a public database that's trust minimized that allows you to store digital works at the same time that screen display is now going from 0 to 100 in terms of innovation. It's like all roads are leading to some very cool stuff over the future. So
I love it.
I think the Sphere is part of this much larger conversation that I think people need to be attuned to.
I need to go to one of the concerts here. It's just so cool. All right, let's move on. Transient Labs, obviously a big partner of ours, has collaborated with Proof on Outliers, which is in the Foundry where we're at right now on these displays. Check out this video with Eli, who is Proof's head of art, chatting with the project about the project with Chris from Transient Labs, who is the COO.
All right, Chris, we are here at the Foundry in downtown Los Angeles at the Proof space. It's so great to have you here, man. We've been working on Outliers, this collaboration between Proof and Transient for some time. Let's take a look at the work here for a moment. These are two pieces from Alien Queen.
Correct, yes. She had this idea of saying, what if the artwork could be affected in some way by the way a collector interacts with it? So imagine being able to feed an artwork mushrooms or something to expand their brain.
That's something the collector can do.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then that changes the artwork based on rules and sort of programmatic things we build into
it's
the
so
art.
Cool. And this is a theme of a lot of the work you guys are doing at Transient, collector, artist, participation, engagement, conversation.
This is just one of the things that the blockchain affords us now, is the ability to create these dynamic and interactive elements between collector and artist.
I've always loved Faux's just aesthetic.
So that painting on a piece of paper with dots turned into how can these areas become fully explorable?
So
how
could each of these
becomes like a world.
Oh, interesting.
You know, like who knows what's behind that?
So I love that.
I'm excited about
this. It's so cool. We have two pieces from Patrick Amidon.
Patrick's thesis was, why have the art asset fixed to a specific thing? Mm-hmm. Why not have an array of information attached? I mean, why not was the question. And so we got to work on how we might create something that would allow a creator to make a piece of art and then add an array of varieties of that artwork into the contract itself. And then the magic of the doppelganger contract is that the creator can always append to array.
Keep adding to that.
Correct.
It's so fascinating. But then this one, this is something that OXDGB did. The cameras project used a different mechanic, the collector's choice piece, right?
Correct. So it's almost a mechanic on top of doppelganger. The big difference here was a collector's choice has a time box on it.
Right.
And so at some point, the creator is saying, you have to make a choice about how you want to lock this. Ayla's been actually like incredibly committed to dynamic art. And so this piece, it changes with time and state. So you saw like fire and water and the body itself. So the piece will change as time progresses day and night based on where the viewer is.
I love that. Let's talk about Ryan and Alice's work here.
This piece is dynamic several ways. This is like a modern interpretation of a cuckoo clock.
Yeah, I love that.
So on the owl takes flight.
Yeah.
And each hour is a separate flight pattern.
So
it's always different. It hoots, it does fun stuff.
Yeah, it's like so cool.
Marlowe's pieces are therapeutic almost, where she's actually intentionally thinking about how the art does something to you as a person. And so she wanted to turn the art into a synthesizer.
Yeah.
Like, how do I interact with the art in a way that is designed to make me see, feel, hear things? And so
that's pretty cool. This is an interesting example of Marlo coming, as you said, with ideas and then with your team being able to construct that into something that we can now have in front of us.
I mean, I think that's what we thought. Oh, if we just took the promise and power potentially of Proof and Transient and we just said, hey, look, if dream something up and we'll figure out how to make it a reality, then these are great examples of like somebody not being constrained by what is possible because we're building for a future that doesn't exist yet. So we have to investigate and kind of break some rules.
This is Tejo.
Yes, it is. Mm-hmm. So using part of our contract called Story Inscriptions, it allows someone to inscribe stories on chain attached to a specific token. So what he chose to do was construct a license agreement about how this derivative project would work. And then that licensing agreement is actually embedded in the metadata of the token. And
I think we're going to see a lot more of this. More of this. This is just the beginning. We will see a lot more from all of the creators, of course.
Definitely.
From Transient, and your team is always pushing the boundaries. So excited to continue this partnership and you know, spend today and the next couple of weeks celebrating all of the creators. Indeed.
What a fantastic partnership this has been with Transient. I mean, just really pushing the envelope on what's possible and not afraid to like break things, try new things.
No, it's been great. I had a chance to speak to the Outliers class of artists, and the talent that you guys were able to source with Transient is next level, and all of them were willing to push themselves technically, creatively, to come up with some wild stuff here. So the Outliers project, I was, you know, going through outputs earlier. It's just really just stellar work across the board.
Yeah, it's been great to have that show here where people can come in off the street, they can come in and check it out, play with it, look at all the different pieces of art. Just a lot of fun. I'm only upset that Eli is stealing my style. That Japanese aesthetic that he's going for has been mine for a while.
It's working really for him, dude.
It's working for him, which is what is upsetting more than anything else. All right, let's move on to our artist spotlight of the day, Entangled Others. This is really awesome to have you two on the show. Felican and Sophia, thank you so much for joining us.
Hello, thank you so much for having us.
Really appreciate you both being here. Would love to like give everyone a sense that people that don't know your work, just kind of where you came from, your kind of emphasis on these artificial life forms and ecology, and combined with a little bit of generative arts. Like you combine all these things in a very unique way that is some really beautiful and compelling outputs. How did you all come together? Where did you get started? Walk us through this stuff.
Yeah, well, funnily enough, we met on Twitter. Felican actually retweeted my work. And it's funny because for me, originally I became interested in AI because I wanted to look at the patterns behind my browser history. So I started thinking like, what, you know, this is kind of scary, like all the amount of information that I'm browsing in a day, what would an AI extract from that? Like, what patterns would I discover if I face that? And so I started playing with that. And then a friend invited me to workshop and started to get like really into AI. And I discovered there's a whole world of people who have been creating generative art all this time, you know, for many decades already. And then, one day Felican just retweeted one of my works, which got inspired by this idea of like looking into, you know, the microscope and observing things that are invisible to naked eye. So I think that's kind of where a huge part of the curiosity came from being able to look at things that we don't normally see, you know, with our eyes.
For those that don't know, we have this the delineation collection up here. You know, I'm really curious, like, is this a microscope? Is it generative? Is it AI? Is it a combination of things? What are we actually seeing here with these works of art?
So what we're looking at here is actually three GANs that are trained on different aquatic life forms that are entangled together using a quantum circuit that is driven by marine data. So basically exploring the interconnectedness of all these different specimens, because very often, you know, from a historical point of view, we tend to see that we think of specimens as discrete units. So this is an octopus, this is a jellyfish, this is a starfish, right? But the reality is that, you know, it's a lot harder to actually define the differences between them and where they stop affecting each other. So, for example, the Amazon rainforest is entirely dependent upon, you know, sands blowing from the Sahara for nutrients. And it's these kind of interconnections that are very hard to see as humans. So we wanted to explore this notion of interconnectedness and how can we, for example, explore using quantum computing to actually show these interconnected aspects of all life around us.
But when you mentioned that these are three GANs, for those that don't know, on the AI side, GANs are these general adversarial networks where you take a series of images, you feed them into the computer, and then they start kind of competing with each other and trying to produce better and better outputs over time. How many images did you feed into these GANs? And then how I'm a little bit lost on how the actual quantum piece ties into all of this.
Right. So the data sets were relatively large. I think there were quite a few tens of thousands of images per GAN. So they were quite laborious to create. And then the entanglement takes place that normally a neural network cannot, you know, reproduce anything outside the data set that it's been trained on, right? So if it's trained on jellyfish, it's never really going to show an image of a fish, right? Mm-hmm. So in this case here, the quantum circuit basically allows for there to be an entangled area within the inference process so that they share a common point where suddenly you see traces of a starfish in a jellyfish or an octopus in a fish and so vice versa. So this, through the simultaneity, the GANs start to produce imagery they're not actually trained on because of this entangled computation.
Yeah, I mean, all that the quantum circuit does is make a random selection. So the idea is that within this circle, all three GANs are talking to each other. So as the videos are rendering, they're all influencing each other simultaneously. And the quantum circuit, all it does is select which one is influencing which one, basically. Mm,
I see.
Yeah. So it's relatively simple when you think about how complex quantum computing is. So, but because we're not engineers, we're artists. So it took us like really long time to even figure out how to do this.
We have an image up here of a tweet that you had posted called self-contained 003. And we're seeing a lot of jumping around here on the left-hand side. Is that the entanglement you're talking about where it's selecting individual components, or is this something completely different?
It's something completely different.
All right, for this piece,
yeah, so for this one, like, we're fascinated by these kind of organic processes that also relate to computation. So if you look at our work, you'll see, you know, there are kind of like the topic of neural networks. Like, neural networks are something that, you know, is organic. Like, we have neural networks running in our brains constantly. And, you know, like, DNA is an organic structure. But we have like algorithmic ways of kind of replicating, or, you know, it's not like an accurate replica, but it's just like an inspiration by a mechanism, basically. So
we wanted to explore, yeah, sort of, you know, this notion of how DNA acts as a means of encoding and decoding information. So here we sort of made a very naive and simple implementation of kind of a pseudogenetic file format, which images are compressed into from the original data sets. And then we, just like as DNA in the wild, you know, is constantly being, you know, crossbred and mutated by random chances, we did the same thing here to evolve an image over time. So you have this sort of mutative evolution of the image driven by the data set of images. And then finally, we use a neural network trained on the same data set to help decompress that back to, you know, something a little more legible. Again, so it was our way of starting to touch upon how can we explore these different ways of using, you know, phenomena in the natural world as a means to also explore, you know, the digital space. Because if you look at memes, for example, you know, we already, you know, practice this culturally in our digital space. You know, we're constantly recontextualizing an image or editing or adding different layers to it. And this kind of mimetic culture is, you know, another expression of that same kind of phenomena.
That's awesome.
Yeah, I'd love to. I'd love to learn a little bit about a little bit more about what's next for you two. I know you both have your own solo work that you do, and I know that you guys have collaborated together on a number of projects through Entangled Others. Maybe I'd talk a little bit about what the world can expect next, about your creative process, how you think about making work, both solo and together, and some of the things and areas that are giving you inspiration in life right now to keep making work.
Well, I mean, we're at the process of figuring out what we're doing next. We're working on kind of physical works at the moment. So like trying to bring, you know, the works that we do, which are so digital, but onto the physical world, which is not always an easy process when you are very used to thinking about software and kind of like, you know, everything is running in a computer. It runs within those rules. And of course, things are constantly breaking there. But when things break in the real world, it's a totally different scenario. So, yeah, so that's kind of like the process that we are in right now.
Yeah, I mean, that's the main focus we've been having now for the last few months, is developing a few different new series of works. So we'll be, so between immersive installations and more, you know, sort of freestanding sculptural works, which is a very slow process, but one that, you know, has been super inspiring to us as well, to explore how can we think about hybridity, you know, not just taking what's for us in the digital is often, you know, a living animated form, you know, that these artificial life forms, you know, are usually brought to life digitally. So we don't want to, you know, just print them out as a static, you know, form, but how can we explore, you know, something that capitalizes on what you can do physically, but that doesn't lose that quality of, you know, being somehow animated or full of life. So, yeah. And I think Solo, you're working on something right now for next month, aren't you? Yeah, we're gonna read that.
Oh, we got some alpha coming.
I'm working on a collaboration with artist Anna Riddler. To me, like, she's a big inspiration because when I started working with AI, she was already, you know, doing that for a while together with her partner, David Pfau. And I don't know, like, maybe you're familiar with her tulips that she minted on the blockchain. They were, I think, like, minted, I don't remember if it was 2018 or 2019. Mm-hmm. So she's really like a pioneer artist. And we're working on a collaboration, which also involves like physical printing. We're both like really into analog photography. So yeah, it combines like kind of, you know, high tech with low tech.
We've lost somewhat of visual, but I've got actually a follow-up question here for the both of you. Something that's always helpful for folks who are truly trying to understand the work that you create is to understand the inspiration behind some of that work. I know you've floated a couple of artists already. It would be fun to talk through maybe some of the work that you see out there in the world that really gives you inspiration, both as artists to make work, ideas that you think are interesting to pursue, and other folks within the world of that you view it give you kind of some inspiration to keep making work in new directions. Are there any artists that come to mind?
Yeah,
there are
so many.
There are an awful lot. I mean, it's in so many different mediums and fields. I mean, personally, I've always, you know, from way back, I've always been super inspired by land art, which is this sort of weirdly site-specific way of working with the natural world. And I found this actually to be a very sort of productive analog for working in the digital, you know, trying to, you know, how do you work in a site-specific manner with what's available to you of data and, you know, environments for coding, and how can that become a productive thing? That's more traditional.
So, for example, the work of Andy Goldsworthy, he makes temporary sculptures with things that he finds in the forest. Mm. And, you know, like, obviously these structures they very often last just a very short amount of time. Like sometimes it's a collection of branches that are like very neatly organized and they get carried by the water in a river. And it's just this unfolding, and he films it and he photographs it with a Hasselblad camera. So he, like, eventually he creates, you know, these beautiful photographs of a moment. And it's just, it's a really like a meditation on impermanence in a way, you know? So there's this, this element of impermanence in his work that we both find really inspiring, and it kind of brings us down to earth, you know, and it helps inform our practice in a way. But who else? Like folks who are more active in the field. I really like Helena Sarin. She's somebody who, you know, has like continuously, you know, she has like a very strong aesthetic and a very strong focus on her work. And I just really like that she's not afraid of continuing like to explore that over and over again. I always feel like she's a very, like she's a very authentic artist. Like she's very loyal to her own artistic vision. She's not trying to like, you know, please anybody necessarily with what she's doing. She's just pursuing that. So that's really inspiring to see.
That's beautiful.
Who else? There are a lot of inspirations.
It's always so hard because then you get off the podcast and you're like, ah, I should have mentioned these three other people. Like,
exactly.
I'm curious. I've got one of your printouts here, by the way, and this one was absolutely gorgeous. That we had up at Venus over Manhattan at our exhibition, which was fantastic. But I also, Sophia, I have to ask you about the Grails piece. We were honored to have you as a Grails artist, and thank you again for that. But can you tell us a little bit about this piece?
Yeah, absolutely. So, okay. So first of all, I was really excited by the idea of making something that, you know, like I didn't know if anybody would be able to figure out that I did it. I made it really difficult. I have to admit, maybe I made it a little bit too difficult. But for me, it was this thing because I love microscopes. I have a microscope since I was a kid, and I still keep that microscope, and I have new ones, of course. And one of the things that I really like doing is walking around and just, you know, gathering a leaf and then looking at it later when I'm back home, just to observe the tiny structures of the cells, or, you know, to look at all these things that exist, but that I'm just not able to perceive with naked eye.
Yeah, and that's so much fun. I'm in the same boat, by the way. I love stuff like that. As a kid, I was always taking stuff in and like looking under a microscope.
Yeah, exactly. So this is kind of like where this work came from. I wanted to look at like ways that life refracts in, you know, like something that I would normally not be able to perceive. So this is a polarized light. And so I use like a polarizing filter in the microscope, and it's refracting on these vitamin C crystals.
Wow.
So yeah, like, I basically, to do this, I bought a bunch of vitamin C. It has to be like pure vitamin C. And then you have to dissolve it in a solution of alcohol. And once the alcohol dries, it forms this kind of crystallized structure. And if you, as it's drying, you break the crystals, it kind of breaks the structure, and it creates this amazing like circles that you see there, you know, like where I poked with a tiny like needle. So yeah, that's basically how the piece was done. And yeah, it's a photograph. So to me, it was like making a generative work, but in a physical way. It has that the elements of a generative aesthetic, but I wanted for people to not know, like, is this a shader or is this a photograph? So
cool.
Yeah.
Awesome. So like Derek mentioned, we know you both do independent art. Is there a Twitter account where people can just follow you and follow along that you do under Entangled Others? I shouldn't say Twitter X now, I guess.
Oh, yeah. For me, it's still Twitter always, but yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
yeah, so Entangled Others is our joint account. Then Felican is Entangled Light on Twitter, and I am Sophie Crespo 91. I know it's a terrible username, but somebody else took Sophia Crespo, so what can I do? So yeah, that's where you can find our work.
Fantastic. Well, excited to hang with you when I make it out to Lisbon again. We had so much fun there doing a proof event out there. Good to see you all. Thank you for being on the show, and just what amazing, beautiful, organic art that is so just good. So unlike a lot of the stuff that we see. So, thank you for all that you do. Great to have you on the show.
Thank you so much for having us.
Derek, another one's done.
Great show. This is a good one.
This is a good one. I'm glad we're here, dude. Like the NFT world is crazy right now. A lot of stuff is going on. A lot of change throughout the entire industry. We're still here, still showing up. I'm bullish as ever.
So much to look forward to.
There's so much to look forward to. Like today was good news story after good news story in terms of like just great art, MoMA, a lot of things that I feel like the tides are slowly going to start 100% to change in our direction.
It's programmed, baby.
I'm excited. It's programmed. Got another unlock. All right, everyone. Thank you so much for tuning in. Special thanks to our guests, Entangled Others, Catch 100 Proof. Special thanks to Sam. Sam's on the screen now.
This morning.
And we got Amanda on there as well. Got the whole crew.
What up, Stevie?
Good to see you all, of course. And Catch 100 Proof live Friday mornings at 10 a.m. Pacific time. And we will see you again next week. Have a great weekend, everyone. We'll be right back.